This is The Liminalist, the podcast between... This is Jason Horsley, and this week I'm talking to Jesse Brown. A story rolls off this tongue, it extols the miles between your son, your child. Remember the days when he was young, wild alive. Well, how did you come to horticulture? How did you find my stuff?
I have a WordPress site, and you were in somebody's podcast role.
Right. I remember that now. Right. So it was really pretty random, just like a.
It was completely random because it picked you out of a list of 50, just based on I didn't know what horticulture meant, so I clicked on it.
That's interesting because, as I said, you're the first person that I knew that had come to me via WordPress, but now that you said that, I think you're the first person I know of who's clicked on my site because they were curious about the name. I'm sure you're not the first ever to, but I've certainly never heard anyone say that before. So that seems...
Oh, it was the Liminalist is what the pod... Yeah.
Okay, so it was
that. It was Liminalist that I clicked on, yeah.
Rather than horticulture, okay. So that's, right. Yeah, that's more. I mean, I think people have expressed curiosity about liminalism. Whereas horticulture, it's been a while since I created that website, since I coined that name, and, you know, now I won't say stuck with it. That would sound negative. Like I felt burdened, I don't, but it's just kind of like I take it for granted, really. That was what I settled on as a form of self-identification, which, you know, as a website, but then that also ties into the whole thing of identifying as autistic, which obviously is kind of what our exchanges have been about primarily. And it's occurred to me that it's been such a long time now since I did identify with autistic. I feel as though it's kind of... in the past, really. I mean, like, it's not like I don't identify as autistic still, it's just that I don't really think about it anymore. It doesn't really seem that important. But one of the reasons that I chose to was that I thought it would be helpful to other people as a way to find me and to find an alternate way of seeing or understanding autism in general, whether or not they identified as autistic. That was one of the primary motives. And I haven't really noticed that. Like, I haven't really noticed attracting many people who are interested in autism or anything like that. So I think you may be one of the first people I've talked to. There's been a few, actually, but it's been a while, actually, since I talked to somebody about autism. So, and if I remember rightly from our exchange, you've gone from... not identifying as autistic to tentatively identifying as autistic and since you discovered the website, is that right?
No, I don't really identify as autistic. I definitely don't identify as neurotypical either. I think so. I guess somewhere in between. I'm coming to realize pretty recently that I'm more sensitive than a lot of people around me. And I don't know if it's psychosomatic, but since I've kind of found out that not everybody is as sensitive as I am, that it's becoming more noticeable in my life. Like I notice now that I move away from bright lights and that I'm always turning the TV at work down, and I read into people's body language and expression and reading in between the lines in ways I guess not everybody does.
Mm-hmm. And you become more conscious of that lately?
Yeah, a lot more lately.
How old are you?
I'm 32.
But do you remember that being... something that you were aware of from an early age, or what is it like looking back now, now that you're more conscious of it?
I don't really know, because memory is a funny thing, and they're all colored by thinking that it wasn't my perceptions that was weird. It was just like my personality,
Yeah.
because I've been called weird since grade school, so
Yeah.
I kind of let other people define me that way, and it's hard to remember. It's hard to remember how you perceived things.
As compared to how you thought about them, you mean?
Most of my memories are just like my early childhood memories. They're just flashes, like feelings, colors, light. Not so much my thought process at the time.
Yeah, that's already going quite far back there, you mean, to early childhood.
Yeah, in high school, I just completely shut down. My peers were mean, and I just kind of stopped trying to be myself and started conforming.
How do you mean shut down?
It's like I started filtering myself.
Yeah. So does that mean that you shut down your feelings?
Oh, I don't know. I probably just put them all in one place. Like getting kind of losing my identity into friends and boyfriends.
Well, when you mention the sensitivity to light, I mean, it's just as one of various things you mentioned. That was what I was curious, you know, how early you were aware of that. I mean, it is a known characteristic of autism in quotes. I put the autism in quotes because we give names to something, it doesn't mean that we've really defined it. But anyway, it was something I had, was a sensitivity to light. I don't know about as a child, but I remember as a teenager, always trying to find bars with the right lighting, and I wouldn't even want to go into a bar if it had bright light. And how I associated the bright light with a feeling of despair, let's say, but associated is not the right word, but it would invoke in me a feeling of despair if the light was too bright. And part of the reason for this was that the brighter the light, so to speak, or this kind of starker the lighting in any environment, the more unreal I would feel. And then that would cause a sense of despair that I just didn't feel real. So there's like a whole kind of complex there, which, well, I mean, who knows, right? What's at the heart of that complex? But it intersects with a seemingly fairly superficial aesthetic preference, let's say, or an aversion, just an aversion to bright light, which caused me anxiety, not in the way that so overt with some autistic kids that they, I mean, they found out with autistic kids that sometimes that their condition or their symptoms or whatever can be alleviated with a simpler technique as tinted glasses. Have you heard about that, the glasses?
Not no, not in that application.
Yeah. Were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just I wear my sunglasses all the time, even
Yeah.
when it's overcast.
Right. It's the goth thing, of course. It is funny how that overlaps, you know, with being cool and all that. Creating an identity that is safe for us, of course, is, you know, what being cool is all about as well. But it's generally assumed that it's just kind of superficial and posy and all that, and culturally indoctrinated, which to some extent it is, being a goth or whatever. But as you point out with the sunglasses, it can also have a actually a pragmatic function as well, like needing to have shields.
Yeah, I used to wear very oversized sunglasses too. I still wear aviators, which are pretty big, and I have a small face, but
Right.
yeah, I guess when bright lights, especially in a white room, just feels to me like really sterile and unwelcome.
It could be a birth memory, now that I think about it.
It could be. I was breech, so I was cesarean.
Well, the thing you
And
brought, yeah, go ahead.
oh, I was, and my mother was unconscious when I was born. So she wasn't actually present for my birth. So that's actually, I never thought about it like that.
Wow. Yeah, well, I mean, even if she had been present, being taken away from the mother was just standard practice. I think it still is. Even taken away from the mother and left in a bright room. It's already bright, I'm sure, in the birth room, but then standard procedure, I think, is just take the infant away and then examine it and whatnot, and then leave it with babies and for a while.
Yeah, my nephew stayed in the room with my sister-in-law. They just took him for a moment to clean him and gave him right back. And they don't have like one of those nurseries you see in the movies at the hospital he was born in.
Right. Well, we jumped right in at the deep end there with birth, because I mean, one of the things I always try to address in these conversations, or at least be aware of, is this, that when we talk about things, we experience them at a much deeper level than just the verbal and the mental. So, I mean, people like to keep the conversation superficial, probably for that reason, because if you talk about profound things, you can try and keep it at a mental level, and you can even convince yourself that you have, but your body is still going to be responding. Memories are being stirred and all the rest of it. So we're talking about birth, and that it's kind of the deepest topic you can talk about, really, in terms of body memories. So yeah. So be careful, right, jumping in too deep, too fast. So, how long have you been blogging?
This blog, well, I had a live journal in high school, but I stopped making my writing public for a long time. I still journaled. I started this blog, and I think in September, so not very long ago.
And what sparked it?
Oh, I got mad at somebody on social media. As embarrassed as I am to say, it was pretty emotional, the reason I started it.
You wanted to, what, expose him or get back at him or?
I felt like she was taking advantage of her audience to. Well, she was taking advantage, in my opinion, of white guilt and white privilege to sell a book about, I don't know what her book was going to be about, but she kind of like wrote an open letter to white women about white privilege, and then said, in my next post, and she like brought white privilege to people's attention, and she said, in my next post, I'll let you know how to be a better person. And then instead, she was like, my emotional labor is not free. So you should wait until I write a book and buy that to find out how you can be a better person. I'm like, hold on a minute. You can't just scold a whole group of people, thousands of women, and make them feel so utterly like ashamed of themselves and then use that to sell them a book. So I wrote her an open letter because she blocked me on social media.
Was this somebody that you knew personally, or just that you discovered online?
That was a post that went viral right after the rally, that rally the right or whatever in Charlottesville.
Rally the right. I don't know what that was. What was that?
There was a demonstration put on by some white nationalists in Charlottesville, North Carolina. And it there were counter protesters, and one of the one of the like original protest the right protesters rammed his car into a crowd and killed somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty tragic.
Is that in your general neighborhood or not?
No, I'm in the Midwest. So, but Indiana is very conservative part of the country, so
Part of the what?
it's a conservative part of the US,
Oh, okay.
one of the more conservative states.
Right, so how is it then living in the US and in this current environment? If that's not too broad a question.
It's frustrating. It's really frustrating. I'm not disengaged. I still know what's going on, and I'll still vote and demonstrate when I think it can make a difference, but I'm having to be really conscious about where I put my energy because I can get overwhelmed and burned out really easily.
By engaging in the debate.
Or just not even when it's not a debate and it's just like m making jokes or making fun of ideas my friends and I don't agree with, even that can be kind of exhausting.
Because it's so fraught, you mean? Because if you say the wrong thing, then there's a payback as a reaction.
I'm not so much worried about saying the wrong thing. I think I just don't deal well with anger, and anger's the appropriate response to injustice and hatred, so.
Well, that's a mouthful right there. I mean, now I'm having to think about, now that we've come a little less deep than birth, and into, social questions and whatnot, societal things, I have to think about, oh, well, this person probably doesn't know much about my stuff because you've just come along recently and maybe read a bit of Seen and Not Seen and listened to a couple of podcasts. Is that right?
I just started your chapter in Seen and Not Seen on Travis and Taxi Driver. And let's see, I started listening to your podcast at the end of September, and I'm current unless you publish something today.
Oh, so that's quite a while. That's a few months. That's probably enough to get a sense that I have a pretty unorthodox take on things and definitely politically and spiritually incorrect one. Is that right? I mean, you've got that sense?
I have the sense that you think for yourself. Yeah.
Well, that's one way of putting it, I suppose. I mean, I mean, I'm very, I live in a small town, so I'm actually just embarked on this project of a newsletter for the town, and so I'm having to consider these questions now in terms of what is politically incorrect, or how incorrect am I at this point? Pretty serious, I think, but in terms of how diplomatic do I need to be about that, and so on. But prior to that, at least, I don't really have to consider in my day, my away from keyboard life, what the sort of current ideology is, even though I'm constantly examining it in my writing. I'm not sure where I was going with this exactly. I mean, seen and not seen is, I suppose, is addressing, how ideology gets incepted in us from an early age, and how it appeals to these very primal patterns of need, and so that's how I see all ideology, to one degree or another, as really sourced in pre-verbal trauma-generated patterns. So then I'm anti-ideology, period, right? So then when you say something like anger is a natural response to injustice, I can't remember the other one. It was injustice and something else.
Hatred.
Hatred, right? Then although I agree for myself, I don't know whether I agree with you, because there's lots of different, there are ideological bases for what constitutes hatred now and what constitutes, and it always has been for injustice, of course, because justice is an ideological construct. You could even say hatred is, I suppose, but certainly now hatred's become an ideological thing, right? Because there's hate crimes. So, yeah. So, anyway, it's kind of a long-winded way, but of saying something. Trying to get a sense of what it is that makes you angry, I suppose. What do you mean by hatred and injustice?
I just mean how different people are granted different freedoms and opportunities. Based on how they identify, or how other people identify them, I guess.
Yeah, more the latter, I think. Although there's an attempt to correct the imbalance with the former, as in people are pushing more and more for the right to identify how they want to. Interesting, I haven't heard anyone say that I'm a rich person in a poor person's body. Seems like that would be an
Oh,
interesting position to take.
well, I mean, that's kind of how every American feels, right? That's why they need to consume so much, because they feel like they're entitled to having things and just buy them, whether they can afford them or not, and accumulate all that debt.
Yeah, true. That's a sort of a universal, so that's probably why it's unsaid. But if you imagine somebody petitioning for the rights to have loads of money in their bank because they were born with a rich person's brain, or something. Anyway, so you have a problem with anger, as in it makes you feel bad, or it creates awkward situations for you, or what?
Yeah, I don't really know. That's something I'm trying to unravel for myself. So I don't think I've ever really had a healthy way to express anger, because women aren't supposed to have that emotion.
I'd say
Actually,
people in general, but yeah, sorry, carry on.
I think men are almost a, well, men aren't allowed to be sad as far as the stereotype goes, and women aren't allowed to be mad.
But I mean, in a social situation, I mean, yeah, if you're talking about movie, archetypal portrayals and stuff, then maybe. But in social situations, men are not really supposed to be angry either. I mean, nobody is. Like, you're supposed to maintain a nice, civil demeanor. Like, if a guy gets angry on a plane, he can get, arrested as a terrorist kind of thing. Well, I suppose a woman could too, but more likely a guy, because he's seen as a threat, a physical threat, as soon as he starts to express anger.
Yeah, I guess my experience has been kind of colored by my relationship with my father. He's really comfortable with being angry. And actually my housemate, my partner, he's really comfortable with being angry too, so maybe I just tend to gravitate toward angry men because I don't know how to express that myself.
Right. So are they comfortable with being angry in all circumstances, or specifically with you mean?
Yeah, it's not directed at me, not usually.
So just out and about, like ordering food in a restaurant or on the public transport, and they're just expressing anger wherever they go.
Yeah, especially traffic, because in traffic, it's just like faceless people, and you're allowed to call them names and yell at them. And
Right. So, yeah, well, I guess that's an interesting. It's a liminal space where we're allowed to express anger is against strangers, particularly if they're passing in cars, so that they'll be gone by the time you've dissed them.
Yeah.
But I would have thought if they were expressed too much anger in the wrong circumstances, circumstances besides the socially acceptable ones, such as driving, then they would also be creating all kinds of problems for themselves, wouldn't they? Like getting into fights or getting thrown out of restaurants and stuff.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Oh, that's the case.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, my partner, when he is out in social situations, he kind of has this. Actually, my dad does too. They both ha kind of have this persona that they put on. The charismatic, polite, perfect. Person,
Yeah.
but then they get home and I get to see what's really behind the mask.
Oh, well, that was what I was asking to begin with. So,
Yeah.
and you're saying, well, they don't really direct it at you, but now you're saying that even if they don't direct it at you, they show it in front of you
Right.
in a way that they don't show it in front of other people.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, that was what I was wondering. I mean, that was certainly the case with my mother, for example. And yeah, I mean, as you pointed out, it's got to be largely our impression or our perception of social reality. It's got to be largely based on our own experience, and, well, obviously entirely really on our own experience, but also our formative experiences. So for me, I associate anger more with women, I guess. Certainly, I'm more frightened of angry women than angry men. And I grew up, my mother had these wild, irrational rages. She was never, very rarely physically violent, but it didn't, I don't know if that would have necessarily been worse, because she was emotionally and verbally so violent, so toxic, that it was quite traumatic, I'm sure. And right through to not her death, because she was very ill in the last year or two, but before she got really ill, she would always vent anger around me and her children in ways that she didn't elsewhere, but also it was so much more palpable to us as children, so other people wouldn't necessarily even notice it if she just huffed and puffed and cursed. To somebody else, it wouldn't seem like a very excessive expression, but to us, because we were kind of hardwired to react to that. The signs of the rage, it felt really impactful. But anyway, I became quite aware in the last few years of how most people who knew my mother just didn't. They talked about it in a way I didn't recognize at all. I was this really light-hearted, easygoing, lovely person. I mean, she'd had that side for sure, but she was also this raging, this inferno of, bottled up despair. So, I suppose we're talking about something that's fairly universal, really, is that the way people let themselves be seen at home and with their loved ones is very different from how they let themselves be seen outside in decent society. And how that's, well, I guess that's the problem with decent society. People have to bottle up and maintain this facade, and that means it comes out the people closest to them.
I agree with that. a kind of society kind of forces us to fraction ourselves.
So then you're what you're saying about anger, is that the same thing then, that you're feeling you have to fracture yourself?
I don't know if it's that I'm afraid my anger is going to like be unwelcome and cause me issues getting along in the world, or if I've kind of outsourced my anger by surrounding myself with people who are much more comfortable expressing it.
Does it make you angry when you're with your husband or your boyfriend or your father, and they're venting? Do you feel anger?
I used to feel really defensive. Like, whether or not it was actually directed at me, I would feel attacked, which would make me try and defend myself, and like excuse my behavior or even defend the person that they're berating by kind of playing devil's advocate.
Right. Did that lead to the anger being directed
Yep.
at
Usually it does.
you? So did you have you changed your tactics then in order for that not to happen? Or?
I have, but I'm not sure it's serving me any better because now I just kind of listen and nod.
Right. Right. And feeling what?
Just kind of trapped because I can't defend, and I don't feel comfortable like joining in on the angry tirade, so I'm just kind of like trapped in between those two.
Yeah. Right. And what are they angry about? I mean, besides, in a general sense, what would you say they're angry about?
Well, the two people that I get to hear lecture most often are, it's funny because one's far left and one's far right, so they're angry about the same issues from completely opposite sides.
And you're right in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's your partner and your father.
Yeah.
That's so archetypal. So you went for the opposite of your father in a certain sense, except that they're the same.
I thought I found somebody that was nothing like my dad, and it turns out he's a lot like my dad.
Just coming from the other angle, from the other side.
Yeah.
Right. So what's an example of something they're both angry about in different ways?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of a way to express it. Because it's their. They both feel like they're being taken advantage of, I guess. So my dad's conservative Republican, and he feels like the government is just giving his money away to everybody. And then my partner is on the other side of that and feels like the rich people are taking up resources from everybody.
Including him, I suppose.
Yeah, of course. He's great at playing the victim.
Is he likely to listen to this conversation if it does become a podcast?
No, he doesn't listen to podcasts at all. Because Yeah, I've tried to get him to, and he flatly refuses, so.
Right, well, this might be a way to get him to listen, of course, but you probably wouldn't want him to.
Yeah, I honestly, he knows how I feel. We had a conversation where I asked him to find a new place to live next last month, so he
Right.
knows how I feel.
So, do you think that, have you thought about how their anger may relate to their being men? I mean, you said how it's easy, it's okay for men to express anger, and then we looked into that and questioned it a little bit. So that was the original kind of context for talking about this. So now I'm wondering if you thought about that their anger itself may have to do with their being men, as in that's what they're angry about, is how men are. How they feel that they're treated as men.
I have. Yeah, and I had a friend that died last month in October, and what most of my friends in that group are male. So, and I was thinking a lot about how differently we're socialized, men and women, especially in how we process emotions. When I was helping my friends kind of grieve. And I was just really struck at how uncomfortable they were with just talking and sharing and being with their grief. So yeah, it is something I think about.
Well, just to stay on that for a second, because you said how maybe it's okay for men to express anger but not to express sadness. So that speaks to that again. And one thing I've observed in my own life is this that, and I have a huge amount of anger. So underneath the anger, my own anger, is a great deal of sadness, and that the anger is one of the primary means I've had to stay out of that sadness. So if that's a universal thing, and I think it is, then it would make perfect sense in a society that discourages men from expressing or even feeling sadness, that they would be indirectly being pushed towards expressing and feeling rage.
Yeah, I kind of experienced that in myself too, because at first when my friend died, I was actually just really mad at him for being so careless with his life. And then as I started to process, I started to feel sad. But it took 2 weeks for me to start to feel sad that he had died.
Did he die of substance abuse?
Yeah.
Incredibly common now. I mean, it's, I think particularly in the US from what I've read, but
Yeah.
all over.
Yeah, the ultimate escapism.
Yeah, and of course, back to not wanting to feel unbearable, unpleasant feelings. Like, that's a great way not to have to feel your feelings, is to use substances to numb them out. But the cost of that is incredibly high, and sometimes, the highest cost there is. I mean, back to my mother, that was very much how I experienced her dying, was that she had such a wealth, a reservoir of grief, hence all the anger, and was not able to process it, and so she drank a lot. I mean, really, like her whole life, she was an alcoholic. And then in those last few years, it was like the toxic buildup of suppressed emotion was eventually it metastasized in a physical illness. Like it was started with severe indigestion and throwing up, and eventually that became stomach cancer. I don't think it was stomach cancer to begin with. I think it was more of an energetic condition. Because emotions, I mean, they are. Obviously, they correspond with chemical processes in the body. Doesn't mean that they simply are, that chemical processes cause us to feel emotions, or that emotions cause chemical processes. I think it's, beneath both is this is an energetic thing, in the psyche. But anyway, that they correlate. So yeah, we escape from those feelings that are only at a severe cost to our bodies.
Yeah, I'm definitely guilty of escaping from my life too. So I'm trying to be more conscious about that.
How do you do that?
I used to watch a lot of TV and smoke a lot of pot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I actually have a history of alcohol abuse too. But I've been gradually tapering off since about last May when it started to affect my health.
Right. I think you mentioned just giving up pot, didn't you? Because it's in my questionnaire. Right. Yeah, I have a rule about not talking to pot smokers. Well, drug users in general. It's pot just comes up more often than others, I suppose. I think there's more habitual pot smokers than there are, or at least with my listeners, anyway. But yeah, I feel very strongly about that, strongly enough to kind of make it a condition, because I just feel that if people are pursuing, escapist practices, then I don't really want to talk to them. I mean, to that extent, it's not that I want to condemn them or anything. I just mean I want to be very selective about who I talk to, because I think it doesn't really land. If somebody's on that, if they're really not even questioning their dedication to dissociation at the cost of their own bodies, they're probably not really going to hear much, because unpleasant realities are hard enough to process as it is, never mind if we're. Was that a sneeze?
Oh no, I had a cold last week and my lymph nodes are still draining.
It wasn't a sneeze.
No, it was a cough.
That was a cough. Okay. So that was like a somatic response. You know about that, that people have unconscious somatic responses when certain subjects come up. That's one of the ways people show that they're uncomfortable.
Oh. Yeah, because you're right about it's hard to grow and grasp big new deep concepts when you're escaping nightly into a cloud of smoke. But part of me still misses it too,
Right.
because it's fun.
Yeah, well, you're pretty young. When I was 32, I was still firmly committed to escapism. I just managed to reframe it as a shamanic path to enlightenment. So I've done a pretty good job of pulling the wool over my eyes. Did you find anything that was pertinent to you in seen and not seen so far, like the stuff about creating our own identities through culture? Was, did any of that speak to you?
Yeah, it kind of raised some questions about the types of movies I always kind of dove into. And how much of that I inherited from like my mom, because my mom's the movie watcher in our family, and how much of it was me kind of, because I like monster movies and horror movies
Right.
and fantasy, and I'm starting to s the my favorite ones were ones with like really enticing villains, and I'm starting to think maybe I was like fractioning even the identity I was creating from movies into a light half and a dark half.
So what was the light part then? Monster movies, and what was the light? Entertainment.
Oh, you know, unicorns,
Oh, okay.
fairies.
Right, gotcha.
Yeah, my favorite movie as a child was Legend. And that's got the most enticing villain in it, I think.
I never saw it. I stayed well clear of that one. Tom Cruise, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, he's in it, but he's not really Tom Cruise, the Tom Cruise we have grown to know now.
Yeah. So who's the villain, or what's the villain?
Tim Curry's like the devil.
Right, gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so the original transvestite, I mean the original media transvestite.
Yep.
Yeah, interesting. I think a lot of people responded to that movie. I think I've heard a few other people say that it was a big movie in their lives.
It's very popular among people that I know, people I used to party with.
Right, so what is it about that movie besides Tim Curry?
I guess the duality of it. Because your good is people who are in touch with nature and bright light, white magic, and then your bad is just like the complete polar opposite in every way.
Yeah, pretty archetypal stuff, good versus evil, but done up. For kids, I suppose. But even that's not that unusual. I mean, Wizard of Oz has good and evil. They all do, don't they?
Yeah, I just found that the contrast really striking in Legend.
Yeah. Well, it's Ridley Scott, so big production. And how do you think that informed your identity?
Don't know. I guess, I think it just gave me permission to box some things off.
Right.
'Cause I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing, and that movie is like very like the good side and the bad side don't share scenes until the end. So it's completely divided.
The end being when good side vanquishes bad side.
Yeah.
Right, so they only meet in order to for the one to destroy the other.
Right.
How did, and you but you said that the villain had, I can't remember the word you used, but was appealing in some way.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Tim Curry. I don't know. There's my mom was obsessed with him, and I guess she showed me Rocky Horror Picture Show entirely too young. So.
Right. She didn't take you to see it with all the
The
audience
audience
participation there.
participation. No, she bought me the audience participation soundtrack, but she never did take me to go see it in the theater. But there wasn't an opportunity anywhere near us, and she is uncomfortable with the interstate, so.
Right, but she loved that movie, and then hence she wanted to see Legend, or she wanted you to see Legend because Tim Curry was in it.
I guess so.
Huh.
Yeah, and he's the bad guy in Ferngully too, which is another movie that stands out from my childhood.
Ferngali. I think that one passed me by. Must have been.
It's an animated movie. Nature versus, pollution type thing.
Oh, so the same as Legend, similar.
Yeah.
Right. Huh. That's a weird thing, isn't it? That they make evil so appealing while at the same time making that contrast so stark. Yeah, what does that do? 'Cause did you identify with Tom Cruise or his character?
I guess so, yeah, 'cause he was trying to rescue. I obviously identified more with the woman, I think her name was Lily in the movie.
Yeah.
But she gets captured. She's not the hero.
She gets captured by Tim Curry.
Yeah.
Right. So it's the Persephone myth, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Except that the Persephone myth doesn't have a hero to rescue Persephone.
Well, in the Persephone myth, her mother's the one that rescues her.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And but also she doesn't really need rescuing. At least not entirely, because she spends her she marries Pluto in the end. Spends half of her time in the underworld and the other half in the upper world.
Right.
So the dark and light are integrated.
Yeah.
So, do you think
You
that
think that
a bit of an echo there,
okay, that.
that you were looking to be rescued then? Is that why you identified with the heroine? Like there was some that you were in circumstances that you were looking for a rescuer?
I don't think so. I think it was I, because in the movie only perfect innocence can touch a unicorn,
Yeah.
so by virtue of her innocence, she was magical.
Yeah. Right, but didn't she need rescuing?
She did need rescuing, but and I guess that could be what appealed to me, but I just think it was the fact there were no that's all female characters in fantasy movies. They all are damsels in distress.
Yeah, well, not entirely, but generally that's the archetypal thing, the setup. But then maybe all children need rescuing. I mean, there's a. Don't know how much I get into it and seen not seen probably not that much the psychological mechanics of it. I certainly talk about how, because I wasn't into monster movies or fairy tales. I was into Clint Eastwood action movies and also horror movies, but not so much monster movies. And I, you won't have got to it yet, but I, or maybe you have. Did you read the chapter on Dirty Harry?
No, I read the chapter on searchers, and You talked about The Man with No Name. Is there a separate chapter on Dirty Harry?
Yeah, I think maybe it does come after the one on Travis. It seems like it would chronologically come before, but
Here, let me grab the book.
yeah, one of the things I zero in on is that how the Clint Eastwood character of Dirty Harry represented something I needed in my childhood, which was somebody to stand up to my brother and protect me from him, and basically a father. I didn't have a father, and he wasn't there. He wasn't. And so the unconscious appeal of Dirty Harry, and it is an archetypal fairy tale as well. It was described that way by Pauline Kael. It's like a knight fighting the dragon, except the dragon is a serial killer. The unconscious appeal of it obviously was much deeper than the conscious. Consciously, I just thought Clint Eastwood's so cool. I love the way he moves. I love his hair. I want to be like that. And just felt the kind of excitement, satisfaction of seeing, a strong man in action. But unconsciously, there was some. It was addressing a really deep need in me, unmet need, a void that was left by my father, and the trauma that I sustained because I didn't have a strong father. I forgot where I was going with that again. Definitely was going to bring it back to legend. I have to take a second to remember. Oh, I know. So in the psychological or some psychological descriptions of trauma and dissociation, they talk about how when the child psyche is impacted with severe trauma, it fragments and it splits, and it creates like it splits into two parts. I mean, more than, well, let's say three parts. Basically, one is the child part, and it stays regressed like this, like into adulthood, that is being traumatized. Which is the one we identify with. Then there's the part of the psyche that identifies with the abuser. You could say the abuser kind of possesses us in that way, this part of the psyche, and that's the villain. And then there's this other part, which is it's kind of a bit like the super ego, really. It's the progress part that grows up too fast in order to try and deal with the abuse. And that becomes our protector, that becomes our savior figure. And so, and that's the dissociation, that's the dissociative state that we enter into. And in when trauma is very intense, we enter into this fantasy realm where we can touch unicorns and where we can fly, and we're superheroes and so on. That's the progressed part. And the regressed part is the infant. Or the child that's traumatized, that stays stuck at that age, and then the guardian figure is the persecutor. So then it's like this complex gets hardwired into our psyches. This is called the self-care system, so that we constantly are reenacting the trauma unconsciously, as a way to try and heal it. But because it's unconscious, it tends to just sort of replay the same scenarios over and over again internally. So then we have the feeling of being a victim, and we have the feeling of, being tormented and victimized. So we scapegoat others, but also we can identify with the victimizer, and ourselves be abusive if we're, with it in anger. And then, but then there's also the progress part, which is the desire to be the pure hero that will rescue us, will rescue ourselves by becoming this thing. So that dynamic in the psyche, I think, is I think it's kind of universal, like how the psyche copes with trauma. It just happens. But then I think that we create and then take refuge in media that kind of reinforces that dynamic in us, that provides us with the sort of narrative that will satisfy that need within us and kind of facilitate that process of self-traumatization, dissociation, and feeling of being rescued.
Yeah.
Right, so it's kind of what you say when I asked how you felt that it shaped your identity. You thought for a very long time, but then you just said you felt that it enabled you to compartmentalize. I can't remember the
Yeah,
words, but roughly that, yeah.
that's what I said, but listening to you, I think you might be right that I did want rescuing. I was pretty sheltered and overprotected growing up. I mean, my mom was really nurturing and always there for me, but she was always there. So maybe, and early in our conversation, when people are angry at me, it makes me feel trapped.
Right.
So maybe I do have this kind of unconscious feeling of being trapped.
That's the end of the first part of this conversation with Jessie Brown. You can find her blog in the show notes. And part two of this conversation will be up at horticulture.com/liminalist next Wednesday, the 13th of December, 2017. If you'd like to support me in this ongoing endeavor, I think you probably already know how to do that. By Seen and Not Seen, Confessions of a Movie Autist, Paper Tiger, there's a new edition out, or Dark Oasis, Self-Made Messiah, and or donate to me via PayPal in the margins of horticulture.com. This is Jason Horsley from the margins. Next week's podcast will be with Branko Malic.
Any psychopath the nose is not the spigot out to save the world from burning. You're just keeping up for yourself. Cause what's more entertaining than a ritual sacrifice on the shadow.